"Gods below!" the guard gasped. "You're bigger than a bargast!"
Mappo Runt ducked his head, embarrassed that he had so shocked this passing watchman. The guard had staggered back, clutching momentarily at his chest. Yes, he was past his prime, but it seemed that the gesture had been just that, a gesture, and the Trell's sudden dread that he had inadvertently sent the first citizen he met stumbling through Hood's gate slowly gave way to shame.
"I am sorry, sir," he now said. "I thought to ask you a question, nothing more."
The guard lifted his lantern higher between them.
"Are you a demon, then?"
"You regularly encounter demons on your patrols? A truly extraordinary city."
"Of course not. I mean, it's rare."
"Ah, I am a Trell from the plains and hills east of Nemil, which lies west of the Jag Odhan in Seven Cities."
"What then was your question?"
"I seek the Temple of Burn, sir."
"I think it best that I escort you there, Trell. You have been keeping to the alleys this night, haven't you?"
"I thought it best."
"Rightly so. And you and I shall do the same. In any case, you are in the Gadrobi district, while the temple you want is in the Daru district. We have some way to go."
"You are very generous with your time, sir."
The guard smiled.
"Trell, you plunging into any crowded street is likely to cause a riot. By taking charge of you, I hope to prevent that. Thus, not generous, simply doing my duty."
Mappo bowed again.
"I thank you even so.
A moment while I douse this light, then follow me. Closely, please."
The fete celebrants in this quarter seemed to be concentrated in the main streets, bathed in the blue glow of the gas lamps. It was not difficult to avoid such places with the watchman guiding him down narrow, twisting and turning alleys and lanes, and those few figures they encountered quickly slunk away upon seeing the guard's uniform and, perhaps, Mappo's massive bulk. Until, behind a decrepit tavern of some sort, they came upon two corpses. Swearing under his breath, the guard crouched down beside one, fumbling to relight his lantern.
"This is becoming a problem," he muttered as he cranked the wick high and a golden glow filled the area, revealing filth-smeared cobblestones and the gleam of pooled blood.
Mappo watched as he rolled over the first body.
"This one's a plain beating. Fists and boots. I knew him, poor man. Losing a battle with spirits. Well, the battle's over now, Beru bless his soul." He moved on to the next one. "Ah, yes. Hood take the one that did this. Four others just the same. That we know of. We still cannot fathom the weapon he uses. Perhaps a shovel handle. Gods, but it's brutal."
"Sir," ventured Mappo, "it seems you have more pressing tasks this night. Directions—"
"No, I will take you, Trell. Both have been dead for a couple of bells now. A little longer won't matter. I think it's time," he added, straightening, "for a mage or a priest to be brought into this."
"I wish you success," Mappo said.
"I can never figure it," the guard said as he led the Trell onward. "It's as if peace is not good enough. Someone needs to crawl out of the pit with blood dripping from his hands, delivering strife, misery." He shook his head. "Could I but shake reason into such abominations? There's no need. No one wants them, and no one wants what they do. What's needed? That's what I wish I knew. For them, I mean. What do they need? What do they want? Is it just that sweet sip of power, domination? The sense of control over who lives and who dies? Gods, I wish I knew what fills their brains."
"No, sir," said Mappo. "Be glad you do not. Even the beasts succumb to such aggression. Killers among your kind, among my kind, are just that. The savagery of beasts mated with intelligence, or what passes for intelligence. They dwell in a murky world, sir, confused and fearful, stained dark with envy and malice. And in the end, they die as they lived, frightened and alone, with every memory of power revealed as illusion, as farce."
The guard had halted, had turned to regard the Trell as he spoke. Just beyond the alley's mouth was a wall, and to the left, the unlit cave of a tunnel or a gate. After a moment, the man grunted, then led Mappo on, into the reeking passageway through the wall, where the Trell warrior was forced to duck.
"You must be a formidable tribe back in your homeland," the guard observed, "if your kin are as big and broad as you are."
"Alas, we are generally not killers, sir. If we had been, perhaps we would have fared better. As it is, the glory of my people has waned."
Mappo then halted and looked back at the gate they had just passed through. He could see that the wall was but a fragment, a stretch no more than 50 paces in length. At both ends, leaning buildings thrust into the spaces where it should have continued on. The guard laughed.
"Aye, not much left of the Gadrobi wall. Just this one gate, and it's used mostly by thieves and the like. Come, not much further."
The Temple of Burn had seen better days. Graffiti covered the plain limestone walls, some the blockish list of prayers, others elliptical sigils and obscure local symbols. A few raw curses, or so Mappo suspected from the efforts made to deface the messages. Rubbish clogged the gutter surrounding the foundations, through which rats ambled. The guard led him along the wall and to the right, where they came out onto a slightly wider thoroughfare. The temple's formal entrance was a descending set of stairs, down to a landing that looked ankle-deep in rainwater. Mappo regarded it in some dismay. The guard seemed to notice.
"Yes, the cult is fading. She has slept too long, I suppose. I know I have no business asking, but what do you seek here?"
"I am not sure," Mappo admitted.
"Oh, well, Burn's blessings on you, then."
"Thank you, sir."
The guard set out to retrace his route, no doubt returning to the alley with the corpses. The memory of them remained with Mappo, leaving him with annoying disquiet. He had glimpsed something of the mysterious wounds on the second body. Brutal, indeed. Would there could be an end to such things, yes, a true blessing of peace. He made his way down the steps, splashed through the pool to the doors. They opened before he could knock. A gaunt, sad-faced man stood before him.
"You had to know, Mappo Runt of the Trell, that it could not last. You stand before me like a severed limb, and all that you bleed stains the ether, a flow seeming without end."
"There will be an end," Mappo replied, "when I have found him once more."
"He is not here."
"I know."
"Would you walk the veins of the earth, Mappo Runt? Is that why you have come to this temple?"
"Yes."
"You choose a most perilous path. There is poison. There is bitter cold. Ice stained with foreign blood. There is fire that blinds those who wield it. There is wind that cries out an eternal death cry. There is darkness, and it is crowded. There is grief more than even you can withstand. There is yielding, and that which will not yield. Pressures too vast even for one such as you. Will you still walk Burn's path, Mappo Runt?"
"I must."
The sad face looked even sadder.
"I thought as much. I could have made my list of warnings even longer, you know. We could have stood in our places for the rest of the night, you in that sodden pool, me standing here uttering dire details, and still, at long last, you would say, 'I must,' and we would have wasted all that time, me hoarse and you asleep on your feet."
"You sound almost regretful, priest."
"Perhaps I am at that. It was a most poetic list."
"Then by all means record it in full when you write your log of this fell night."
"I like that notion. Thank you. Now come inside and wipe your feet. But hurry, we have been preparing the ritual since your ship docked."
"The breadth of your knowledge is impressive,"
Mappo said, as, ducking, he stepped inside.
"Yes, it is. Now follow me."
A short corridor, ceiling dripping, into a broader transept, across a dingy mosaic floor, down a second corridor, this one lined with niches, each home to a holy object, misshapen chunks of raw ore, crystals of white, rose and purple quartz and amethyst, star stones, amber, copper, flint and petrified wood and bones. At the end of this passage, the corridor opened out into a wider colonnaded main chamber, and here, arrayed in two rows, waited acolytes, each wearing brown robes and holding aloft a torch. The acolytes chanted in some arcane tongue as the high priest led Mappo down between the rows. Where an altar should have been at the far end, there was instead a crevasse in the floor, as if the very earth had opened up beneath the altar, swallowing it and the dais it stood on. From the fissure rose bitter, hot smoke. The sad-faced high priest walked up to its very edge, then turned to face Mappo. "Burn's gate awaits you, Trell." Mappo approached and looked down, to see molten rock 20 spans below, a seething river sweeping past. "Of course," the high priest said, "what you see is not in this realm. Were it so, Darujistan would now be a ball of fire, bright as a newborn sun. The caverns of gas and all that."
"If I jump down there," Mappo said, "I will be roasted to a crisp."
"Yes, I know what you must be thinking."
"Oh?"
"Some gate."
"Ah, yes, accurate enough."
"You must be armored against such forces. This is the ritual I mentioned earlier. Are you ready, Mappo Runt?"
"You wish to cast some sort of protective spell on me?"
"No," he replied, with an expression near to weeping. "We wish to bathe you in blood."
Barathol Mekar could see the pain in Selara's eyes when they turned inward in a private moment, and he saw how Char held himself close to her, protective in some instinctive fashion as might be a dog with a wounded master. When she caught Barathol studying her, she was quick with a broad smile, and each time he felt as if something struck his heart like a fist against a closed door. She was indeed a most beautiful woman, the kind of beauty that emerged after a second look, or even a third, unfolding like a dark flower in jungle shadows. The pain in those eyes only deepened his anguish. Cutter was a damned fool. Yes, there had been another woman, his first love, most likely, but she was gone. Time had come to cut the anchor chain. No one could drown forever. This was what came of being so young, and deftness with knives was a poor replacement for the skill of surviving everything the world could throw in the way. Longing for what could never be found was pointless, a waste of time. Barathol had left his longing behind, somewhere in the sands of Seven Cities, a sprawl of motionless bodies, mocking laughter disguised as unceasing wind, a lizard perched like a gift on a senseless black-crusted hand. Moments of madness, oh, long before the madness of the Tlani Mas in Aran, when he had railed at remorseless time, at how too late was something that could not be changed. Not with blood spilled at the foot of a god, not with a knife poised to carve out his own heart. Too late simply grinned at him, lifeless, too poignant for sanity. Those two words had begun a chant, then stride by stride a gleeful echo, and they had lifted to a roar in the raiders' camp, amidst screams and the clash of iron. Lifted, yes, into a deafening maelstrom that crashed inside Barathol's skull, a surging tide with nowhere to go. Too late cannot be escaped. It crooned with every failed parry, every failed dodge from a scything weapon. It exploded in eyes as death hammered home, exploded along with blood and fluids. It lunged in the wake of toppling bodies. It scrawled messages, ever the same message, in the sands dying men crawled across. He could have chanted forever, but he had left no one alive. Oh, a dozen horses that he gave away to a caravan some days later, a gift for taking in the half-dead warrior, for treating his raging fever, for cleaning his wounds and burning out infection. They would accept no payment for their efforts. They could do nothing for the bleak anguish in his soul, they explained, and so to ask for anything would be dishonorable. Now a gift, well, that was different. In the desert, nothing disguised time's cruel face. Its skin was stretched to the bone. Its lone eye burned the sky, and its gaping mouth was cold and airless as a mountain peak. The traders understood this. They were as much a tribe of the desert as anyone, after all. They gave him bladders of water, enough to take him to the nearest garrison outpost. "Aye, give the Mesla that! They know how to build way stations and equip them well. They turn no one away, friend." They gave him the strongest of the raiders' horses, a fine saddle, jerked meat and dried fruit. They gave him feed for the mount to last 4 days, and finally they showed him the track he would take, the path that cheated death, and yes, it was the only one. Death stalked him, they said, waited, for now, out beyond the glare of the dung fires, but when Barathol finally rode out, the reaper with the long legs would set out after him, singing of time, singing of the hunger that never ended, never slowed, never did anything but devour all in its paths.
"When longing comes to you, friend, step not into its snare, for longing is the fatal bait. Find yourself in its snare, and you will be dragged, dragged through all the time allotted you, Barathol Mekar, and nothing you grasp will remain, all torn from your fingers. All that you see will race past in a blur. All that you taste will be less than a droplet, quickly stripped away. Longing will drag you into the stalker's bony arms, and you will have but a single last look back onto your life, a moment of clarity that can only be some unknown god's most bitter gift. And you will understand all at once all that you have wasted, all that you let escape, all that you might have had. Now ride, friend, and wear the traps of your mind."
Too late. Those two words haunted him, would perhaps forever haunt him. The cruel chant had filled his head when he'd looked down upon Chowra's drowned face. Too late. But he'd spat into that gleeful cry. That time, yes, he had. He had said no, and he had won. Such victories were without measure. Enough to hold a man up for a while longer. Enough to give him the courage to meet a woman's eyes, to meet unflinching what he saw there. In cavorting, clashing light, faces smeared past as they walked through the crowd. Rollicking songs in the local tongue, jars and flasks thrust at them in drunken generosity. Shouted greetings, strangers in clutches by walls, hands groping beneath disordered clothing, the smell of sex everywhere. Barathol slowed and half turned. Celara was laughing.
"You lead us into most unusual places, Barathol. This street called out to you, did it?"
Chowra was staring at the nearest pair, mouth hanging open as his head unconsciously began bobbing in time with their rhythmic thrusts.
"Gods below," Barathol muttered. "I wasn't paying much attention."
"So you say. Of course, you were on that boat for a long time, pretty much alone, I'd wager. Unless Spite decided..."
"No," he cut in firmly. "Spite decided nothing of the sort."
"Well then, the city beckons with all its carnal delights. This very street, in fact..."
"Enough of that, please."
"You can't think I'll ease up on you, Barathol."
Grimacing, he squinted at Chowra.
"This is disturbing him."
"It is not. It's exciting him. And why wouldn't it?"
"Celara, he may have a man's body, but his is a child's mind."
Her smile went away and she nodded thoughtfully.
"I know. Awkward."
"Best we leave this," Barathol said.
"Right. Let us find somewhere to eat supper. We can make plans there." But the issue won't go away, I suspect. He's caught the scent, after all. Moving to either side of Chower, they turned him about and began guiding him away. He resisted briefly, but then fell in step, joining in with a nearby chorus of singers with loud, wordless sounds not quite matching their somewhat better efforts.
We really are the lost ones, aren't we? Silara said. We need to find ourselves a purpose in life. Aye, let's grasp our biggest, most glaring flaw, shall we? Never mind what to do tomorrow or the day after. What to do with the rest of our lives? Now there's a worthy question.
He groaned.
Seriously, if you could have anything, anything at all, Barathol, what would it be?
A second chance. There's no point in that question, Silara. I'll settle for a smithy and a good day's work, each and every day. I'll settle for an honest life.
Then that's where we'll start. A list of necessary tasks, equipment, location, guild fees and all that.
She was trying hard, he could see, trying hard to keep her own feelings away from this moment, and each moment to come, for as long as she could.
I accept no payments, Silara, but I will take your gift, and give you one in turn. Very well, I can certainly use your help in all that.
Good. Look, there's a crowded courtyard with tables, and I see food and people eating.
We can stand over a table until the poor fool sitting at it leaves. Shouldn't take long. Blend withdrew her bared foot from Picker's crotch and slowly sat straight.
Be subtle, she murmured, but take a look at the trio that just showed up.
Picker scowled.
Do you always have to make me uncomfortable in public, Blend? Don't be silly. You're positively glowing. With embarrassment, yes. And look at Ansi. His face is like a sun-baked crab shell. It's always like that, Blend said.
I don't mind, Ansi said, licking his lips. I don't mind at all what you two get up to, in public or in that favourite room you use, the one with the thin walls and creaking floor and ill-fitting door.
A door you were supposed to fix,
snapped Picker. Only now half turning to take in the newcomers. She flinched, then huddled down over the table.
Gods below! Now don't that grizzled one look familiar?
I've been trying to fix it, honest. I work on it all the time.
You work all right, with one eye pressed to the crack,
Blend said.
You think we don't know you're there, sweating and grunting as you...
Be quiet!
Picker hissed.
Didn't you two hear me? I said... He looks just like Kalameka, aye,
Ansi said, poking with his knife at the chicken carcass on the platter in the centre of the table.
But he's not Kalam, is he? Too tall, too big, too friendly looking.
He frowned and tugged at his moustache.
Who was it said we should eat here tonight?
That bard, said Picker.
Our bard? For the rest of the week, aye. He recommended it.
He said we should eat here tonight, is what he said. Is that a recommendation?
Might be, but maybe not. He's an odd one.
Anyway, he said it would be open till dawn.
The chicken was too scrawny, and I don't know who they got to pluck the damned thing, but I'm still chewing on feathers.
You were supposed to avoid the feet, Ansi, said Blend. They didn't even wash those.
Of course they did, Ansi protested. That was sauce.
The sauce was red. The stuff on the feet was dark brown. Want something to get embarrassed about, Picker? Just drag Ansi along to supper.
The feet was the best part, the Falari said.
He's seven cities for sure, Picker noted. All three of them, I'd wager.
The fat one likes a rust leaf.
If she's fat, Ansi, then so am I.
Ansi looked away. Picker cuffed him on the side of the head.
Ow! What was that for?
I wear armour and quilted underpadding, remember?
Well, she's not, is she?
She's delicious, Blend observed, and I bet she don't get embarrassed by anything much.
Picker offered her a sweet smile.
Why not go stick your foot in and see? Ooh, jealous.
Ansi sat up, suddenly excited. If your legs was long enough, Blend, you could do both, and I could...
Two knives slammed point first into the table in front of the ex-sergeant. His bushy brows shot upward, eyes bulging.
Just an idea, he muttered. No reason to get all uppity, you two.
Could be he's another Calam, Picker said. A claw.
Ansi choked on something, coughed, hacked, then managed a breath. He leaned forward until he was very nearly lying on the table from the chest up. He chewed on his moustache for a moment, eyes darting between Picker and Blend.
Listen, if he is, then we should kill him.
Why?
Could be he's hunting us, Picker. Could be he's come to finish off the bridge burners once and for all.
Why would any of them care? Picker asked.
Maybe the bard set us up. Did you think of that?
Blend sighed and rose.
How about I just go up and ask him?
You want to take a grab at a tit, Picker said, smiling again.
So go ahead, Blend. Go on. See if she blows you a kiss.
Shrugging, Blend set out to where the three newcomers had just acquired a table. Ansi choked again, plucked at Picker's sleeve and gasped.
She's heading straight over!
Picker licked her lips.
I didn't really mean...
She's almost there! They've seen her! Don't turn round!
Barathol saw the Malazan threading her way to where they now sat. By hue of skin, by cast of features, by any obvious measure one might find, there was nothing that differentiated the woman from any local Daru or Jenabari. Yet he knew instantly, a Malazan and a veteran, a damned marine. Silara noted his attention and half turned in her chair.
Good taste, Barathol, and it seems she likes...
Quiet,
Barathol muttered. The slim woman came up, soft brown eyes fixed on Barathol. And in Malazan she said,
I knew Calam.
He snorted.
Yes, he's a popular man.
Cousin?
He shrugged.
That will do. Are you with the embassy?
No, are you?
Barathol's eyes narrowed. Then he shook his head.
We arrived today. I never directly served in your empire.
She seemed to think about that. Then she nodded.
We're retired, causing no trouble to anyone.
Sounds retired indeed.
We run a bar, Kurul's, in the Estates District, near Worry Gate.
And how does it fare?
Slow to start, but we're settled in now, getting by.
That's good.
Come by, I'll set you the first round.
We just might.
She glanced down at Silara then and winked, then turned away and walked back to her table.
What just happened?
Silara asked after a moment. Barathol smiled.
Do you mean the wink or all the rest?
I figured out the wink, thank you. The rest.
The deserters, I'd wager, worried that we might be imperial. That I might be a claw, come to deliver a message from the Empress, the usual message to deserters. They knew Calam Mekar, a relation of mine, who was once a claw and then a bridge burner.
A bridge burner? I've heard about them. The nastiest company ever. Started in Seven Cities and then left with Dujek.
The same.
So they thought you were here to kill them?
Yes.
So one of them just decided to walk up and talk to you. That seems either incredibly brave or profoundly stupid.
The former, said Barathol, about what you'd expect from a bridge burner, deserter or otherwise.
Silara twisted round, quite deliberately, to study the two women and the red-bearded man at the table on the other side of the plaza, and did not flinch from the steady regard they then fixed on her. Amused, Barathol waited until Silara slowly swung back and reached for her jar of wine before saying,
Speaking of brave.
Oh, I just don't go for that kowtowing stuff.
I know.
So do they now.
Right. Shall we join them then?
Silara suddenly grinned.
Tell you what, let's buy them a pitcher, then watch and see if they drink from it.
Gods, woman, you play sharp games.
Nah, it's just flirting.
With what?
Her smile broadened, and she gestured over a nearby server.
"Now what?" Ansi demanded.
"Guess they're thirsty," Picker said.
"It's that quiet one who worries me," Ansi continued. "He's got that blank look, like the worst kind of killer."
"He's a simpleton, Ansi," said Blend.
"Worst kind of killer there is."
"Oh, really? He's addled a child's brain. Look how he looks round at everything. Look at that silly grin."
"It's probably an act, Blend. Tell her, Pick, it's an act. That's your claw right there. The one that's going to kill us, starting with me, since I ain't never had no luck, except the pushing kind. My skin's all clammy already, like I was practicing being a corpse. It's no fun being a corpse, take it from me."
"That explains the fingernails," Blend said.
Ansi frowned at her. The server, who had just been at the other table, now arrived, delivering a large clay jar.
"Wine," she said. "Compliments of them three over there."
Picker snorted.
"Oh, that's cute. And now they want to see if we drink from it. Get that wench back here, Blend. Buy them a bottle of white apricot nectar. Returning the favour, like."
Blend rolled her eyes.
"This could get expensive," she said as she rose.
"I ain't drinking from nothing I didn't buy myself," Ansi said. "We should have brought Blue Pearl. He could have sniffed out whatever. Or Mallet. They got poisons so secret here there's no taste, no smell. The one drop that kills you don't even feel wet. Why, all you need to do is look in its direction."
"What in Hood's name are you going on about, Ansi?"
"You heard me, Pick.
Pour me some of this wine, then. Let's see if they got good taste."
"I ain't touching that jar. Could be powdered with something."
"Only if the wench was in on it. If she wasn't, and there was, she'd be dead, right?"
"She don't look too healthy to me."
"You'd look pretty rough, too, with all the cysts she's got on her head and neck.
Some Daru poisons show up as knobby lumps."
"Gods below, Ansi!"
Picker reached across and collected the jar, filled her goblet, drank down a mouthful of the amber liquid.
"There, not half bad. We got better in our cellar, I'm pleased to say."
Ansi was studying her with slightly bulging eyes. Blend returned, sank into a slouch in her chair.
"On its way," she said. "How was the wine, Pick?" "Passing. Want some?" "All this trudging back and forth has worked up a fierce thirst, so fill it up, darling."
"You're both suicidal," Ansi said.
"We're not the ones feeling clammy, are we?" "There are some poisons," Picker said, "that kill the person next to the one who took it."
The ex-sergeant lurched back in his chair.
"Damn you! I heard of those! You killed me!"
"Calm down," Blend interjected. "She was teasing you, Ansi. Honest. Right, Picker?" "Well, if you don't want his knife in your throat, Pick, tell him quick." "Aye, a jibe, a jest, teasing, nothing more. Besides, if you're naturally clammy, you're immune."
"You must think me an idiot, Pick, both of you."
When neither objected to that assertion, the Falari snarled and took the jar from Blend, raised it defiantly to his mouth and downed the rest of the contents in a cascade of gulps, his oversized apple bobbing as if he was trying to swallow a cork.
"A fearless idiot,"
Blend said, shaking her head. Ansi sucked on his moustache ends for a moment, then thumped the empty jar onto the tabletop. He belched. They watched as the wench delivered the bottle of white apricot nectar. A brief conversation with the woman ensued, whereupon she flounced off with a toss of her knobby head. The pleasantly plump woman and the Mekar both poured a healthy measure of the liquor. With a bold toast in the Malazan's direction, they sipped.
"Look at that," Blend said, smiling. "Such handsome shades of green."
And the woman was on her feet, was marching over. Ansi set a hand on the grip of his short sword. In Malazan, tainted with the accent of seven cities, the woman, with a hard frown, said,
"You trying to kill us or something? That was awful." "It gets better," Blend said with an innocent blink. "Really?
And when would that be?
Well, embalmers swear by it.
The woman snorted.
Damn the Mesler. This is war, you know.
And she spun about and walked, a little unsteadily, back to her table. The server was simply waiting in the wings, it turned out, as she arrived at the table moments after the Seven Cities woman sank down into her chair. More conversation, another toss of the head, and off she trundled. The bottle she showed up with was of exquisite multi-hued glass, shaped like some giant insect.
"This is for you," the server snapped, "and I ain't playing no more, no matter how much you tip me. Think I can't work this out? Two women and a man here, one woman and two men are there. You're all disgusting, and when I tell the manager, well, banning the likes of you won't hurt us none, will it?"
A whirl, nose in the air, and a most impressive stalk to the restaurant's nether regions, or wherever it was managers squatted in the nervous gloom common to their kind. The three Malazans said nothing for a long time, each with eyes fixed upon that misshapen bottle. Then Picker, licking dry lips, asked,
"Male or female?"
"Female,"
Ansi said in a thin, grating voice, as if being squeezed from below.
"Should smell sweet."
Clearing her throat, Blend said,
"They just won the war, didn't they?"
Picker looked at her.
"A damned slaughter, too."
Ansi moaned.
"We got to drink it, don't we?"
The two women nodded.
"Well," he said, "I once plunged straight into a squad of Crimson Guard.
You fell out of the tree
and made it out alive, and I once stood down a charging wild boar."
"Wasn't wild, Ansi. It was Trot's pet, and you made a grunt that sounded just like a sow."
"And at the last moment, I jumped right over it.
It threw you into a wall.
So if anyone here's got the guts to start, it's me."
And with that, he reached for the bottle of Quall milk, paused to study the sigil on the stopper.
"Green Marantz, the cheap brand. Figures."
The normal dosage was a thimbleful, sold exclusively to women who wanted to get pregnant. Maybe it worked, maybe it didn't. Maybe all it did was shock the body into pregnancy. Anything to avoid another taste of that stuff. Picker drew out a pale handkerchief and waved it over her head. They'd have to offer them rooms now, at least a week's stay, she judged.
"Us Mesler just got trounced. Gods, it's about time we met folk worth meeting. Makes it almost worth drinking Quall milk."
Ansi drank down a mouthful, then set the bottle down, and promptly passed out, crumpling like a man without bones, except for his head, which crunched audibly on the cobbles.
"Almost worth it."
Sighing, she reached for the bottle. To Blend, she said,
"Good thing your foot's been neutered, love."
"Don't you mean sterile?"
"I ain't that delusional," Picker replied. "Be sure they promise to hire us all a carriage before you drink, Blend."
"I will. See you tomorrow, sweetie."
"Aye."
Crones circled the edge, fixing one eye, then the other, on the strange apparition swirling above the enchanted dais. The power of the high alchemist's sorcery was as sweet and intoxicating as the pollen of Debayang poppies. But that which came from the demon was foul, alien. Yet, the great raven knew, not quite as alien as it should be. Not to her and her kind, that is.
"You are bold,"
she said to Baruch, who stood facing the dais with hands folded.
"And the reach of your power and will is most impressive."
"Thank you,"
replied the high alchemist, squinting at the demon he had conjured and then trapped.
"Our conversations have been most enlightening. Of course, what we see here is not a true physical manifestation, a soul, I believe, disconnected from its corporeal self."
"With eyes of jade,"
Crone noted, beak opening in silent laughter. She hesitated, then asked,
"What has it told you?"
Baruch smiled. From the mantle above the fireplace, Chilbase wheezed derisively and made insulting gestures with its stubby hands.
"You should spike that thing to a wall,"
Crone hissed.
At the very least, send it back up the chimney and thus out of my sight.
Baruch spoke as if he had not heard Crone's complaining.
Its body is very far away indeed. I was granted an image of the flesh, a human as far as I could tell, which is in itself rather extraordinary. I was able to capture the soul due to its heightened meditative state, one in which the detachment is very nearly absolute. I doubt the original body draws breath 10 times a bell. A most spiritual individual, Crone.
The great raven returned her attention to the apparition, studied its jade eyes, its jagged traceries of crackling filaments, pulsing like a slowed heart.
"And you know, then," she said. "Yes, the demon is from the realm of the Fallen One, his birthplace."
"Meditating, you say? Seeking its god?"
"That seems likely,"
Baruch murmured.
"Reaching, touching, recoiling.
From the agony, from the ferocious fires of pain.
I will send it home soon."
Crone half spread her wings and hopped down onto the tiles. Cocking her head, she fixed an eye upon the high alchemist.
"This is not simple curiosity."
Baruch blinked, then turned away.
"I had a guest not so long ago."
"In truth?"
The high alchemist paused, then shook his head.
"Half truth."
"Did he sit in a chair?"
"Well, now, that would hardly be appropriate, Crone," she laughed.
"Shadow Throne!
Please do not act surprised,"
Baruch said.
"Your master is well aware of such matters. Tell me, where are the rest of them?"
"Them?
The gods and goddesses, the ones cringing every time the crippled god clears his throat. So eager for this war, as long as someone else does the fighting. None of this should be set at your lord's feet. I don't know what Shadow Throne has offered Anamanda Rake, but you would do well to warn your master, Crone. With Shadow, nothing is as it seems. Nothing."
The great raven cackled, then said,
"So true, so true."
And now it was his turn, she noted, to regard her with growing suspicion.
"Oh, Baruch! People raise standing stones one after another, only to topple them down one by one. Is it not always the way? They dig holes only to fill them in again. As for us great ravens, why, we build nests only to tear them apart next season. All because the mad lizard in our skulls demands it. See your demon on the dais. It pays nothing to be spiritual, when it is the flesh that ever clamors for attention. So send him back, yes, that he can begin to repair all the severed tendons, whilst his comrades witness the distance of his gaze and wonder and yearn to find the same otherworldliness for themselves, fools that they all are. Have you exhorted him to pray all the harder, Baruch?" "I thought as much, but it's no use, I tell you, and who better to make such judgment? And consider this, my master is not blind. He has never been blind. He stands before a towering stone, yes, and would see it toppled. So, old friend, be sure to stay a safe distance."
"How can I?"
the high alchemist retorted.
"Send the soul home,"
Crone said again.
"Look to the threat that even now creeps closer in the night. That is but moments from plucking the strands of your highest wards, to announce her arrival, yes, to evince her desperation."
She hopped towards the nearest windowsill.
"For myself, I must now depart, yes, winging away most quickly."
"A moment. You have lingered, Crone, in search of something, and it seems you have found it."
"I have,"
she replied, cackling again.
"Well?"
"Only confirmation, to ease my master's mind."
"Confirmation? Ah, that Shadow Throne spoke true."
A third cackle from the sill, as threes were ever preferable to pairs. Not that Crone was superstitious, of course, but if only two, then a third would sound somewhere, and might that one not be at her own expense? Not to be, oh no, not to be.
Farewell, Baruch!
Moments after he closed the window in the wake of that oily black-tarred hen, Chilbase lifted his head and cried out,
She comes! She comes!
Yes, Baruch sighed.
Deadly woman!
Not this time, little one. Fly to Derudan, and quickly. Tell her from me that the one who once hunted us has returned to discuss matters. Further, Chilbase, invite Derudan to join us as soon as she is able. She will understand, I am sure, the need.
Chilbase flapped, well, mostly fell, to the floor in front of the fireplace, then scrambled into the embers and vanished up the chimney. Baruch frowned at the conjured demon spinning above the dais. Then, with a single gesture, he released the spirit, watching as the swirling energy dwindled, then winked out.
Go home, lost one, with my blessing.
And then he stood, facing the wall she would come through. Stood, awaiting Vorkan. No longer afraid of her. No, the terror he was feeling belonged instead to her reason for coming. As for the mistress of assassins herself, damn, but he had harsh words awaiting her.
You killed the others, woman. All but myself and Derudan. Yes, only the three of us left. Only three. To stop, if we can, the return of the tyrant. Oh, Vorkan, you toppled far too many stones that night.
Should he have asked Anamanda Rake for help? Gods below, it had been as close to offered him as it could have been, if he understood Crone, and he was sure that he did, at least in that matter. And if he chose to accept that offer, should he tell Derudan and Vorkan? How could he not? Neither would be pleased, he was sure, especially Vorkan, and their fragile, and yes, it would be most fragile, alliance might die in the very moments of its birth.
Oh, Baruch, be open, be honest with them both. Ask them. Simple as that.
Yet even as he saw the wall before him blurring, seeming to melt, a figure slowly, cautiously stepping through, he knew he would not, could not. There were but three of them left now, not enough to stop the tyrant's return, even with Rake's help. Not enough.
Which means one of us will choose to betray the others, currying favor for when he returns. Favor, well, bargaining to stay alive would be more accurate. One of us will betray the others. Maybe Derudan. Maybe this one here. Gods, maybe me.
He stood 30 paces up the street. Beneath the hood, his eyes held unwavering on the ill-lit entrance to the Phoenix Inn. On the old steps, on the tattered sign still hanging misaligned above the inset door. For 100 heartbeats he had watched as figures entered, others left, no one as yet familiar to him, as if in his absence all that he had known had vanished, melted away, and now strangers sat where he had once sat. Held tankards he had once held, smiled at the servers and flung out over-familiar suggestions as they swayed past. Cutter imagined himself inside, imagined the resentment there on his face as he looked upon a score or more intruders, invaders into his own memories, each one crowding him, trying to push him out. And on, to whatever new life he had found, which was not in the Phoenix Inn, not even in Darujistan. There was no returning. He had known that all along, at least intellectually, but only now, as he stood here, did the full realization descend upon him, a burden of such emotion that he felt crushed by it. And was it not equally true that the man behind the eyes was not the same man from those years past? How could he not see it differently, with all that he had been through, with all that he had seen and felt? His heart thundered in his chest. Each drumming thud, he now understood, was, once done, never to return. Even the repetition was in truth nothing but an illusion, a sleight of similitude. It might be a comfort to pretend that the machinery never changed, that each pulse and swirl was identical, that a man could leap back and then forward in his mind, and no matter where he ended up, all that he saw would remain the same, fixed like certainty. The rough stones of the dank walls, the quality of the yellow light bleeding from the pitted glass window, even the susurration of sound, the voices, the clank of pewter and fired clay, the very laughter spilling out as the door was opened, spilling out sour as bile as far as Cutter was concerned. Who was left in there that he might recognize? The faces tugged a little older, shoulders a fraction more hunched, eyes framed in the wrinkled map of the weary. Would they light upon seeing him? Would they even know him? And even then, after the slapped backs and embraces, would he see something gauging come into their eyes, painting colourless their words, a certain distance widening with every drawn-out moment that followed? The faintest scrape of a boot 2 paces behind him, spinning round, ducking low as he did so, daggers flashing in both hands, left blade half-raised, point downward into a guard position, right blade darting out in a stop thrust, and the figure leaned back with a soft grunt of surprise, Tialuk knife snapping out from beneath a cloak to block the dagger. Cutter twisted his wrist to fold into that parry, flicking his blade's edge into a deep slice across the base of the attacker's gloved palm, even as he lunged forward, staying low, and slashed his left-hand dagger for the indent beneath his foe's right kneecap. Avoiding that attack very nearly toppled the man straight into Cutter's arms, but Cutter had already slipped past, slicing both blades for thigh, then hip, as he darted by on the man's left. Amazingly, that heavy Tialuk caught every slash, and another of the oversized, hooked knives now appeared in the man's other hand, straightening in a back-flung stop thrust in case Cutter pivoted round to take him from behind. Cutter was forced to pitch hard to evade that damned fend, and, balanced on one leg, he threw the dagger in his left hand, sidearm, launching the weapon straight for the man's shadowed face. Sparks as, impossibly, the man batted the flying weapon aside. A new knife already in that hand, Cutter made to launch yet another attack. Then he skidded on his heels and leaned back into an all-out defense as the man came forward, his heavy knives whirling a skein before him. Two of those? Two? Wait! Cutter cried out. Wait! Ralik! Ralik! The Tialuks withdrew. Blood spattered down from the one in the right hand, where the palm had been laid open. Dark eyes glittered from beneath the hood. Ralik, it's me! Cut Crocus! Crocus Younghand!
As I'd first thought, came the rumbling reply, only to change my mind in a hurry. But now, yes, it is you. Older gods, I have indeed been away a long time. I cut your hand, I'm sorry. Not half as sorry as me, Crocus. You are in the guild now, aren't you? Who has trained you? Not Seba Krafa, that's for sure. I don't recognize the style at all.
What? No, no guild. Not anything like that, Ralik. I've been... Wait, you said you've been gone? From Darujistan? Where? How long? Not since that night behind Kohl's, but...
Aye, Ralik cut in. It's you, all right.
God's below, Cutter said. But it's so good to see you, Ralik Nom. I mean, if I'd known it was you at first, you shouldn't come up on a man from behind like that. I could have killed you.
The assassin stood studying him. Suddenly trembling, Cutter sheathed his knives, then began looking around for the one he'd thrown.
Two of those pig choppers. Who else would use those? I should have realized when I saw the first one. I'm so sorry, Ralik. Instincts took over. They just took over.
You did not heed my warning, then.
Years ago, those dark, angry words, but Cutter did not need to ask what warning. He remembered it all too well.
I would have, he said, pausing in his search. Truly, Ralik. I went with the Malazans, you see, and Apsala. Fiddler, Kalam, the four of us to Seven Cities, where everything changed.
When did you return, Crocus?
Today, tonight.
He glanced ruefully at the entrance to the Phoenix Inn.
I've not even gone inside yet. It's Changed. Aye, that word is already starting to haunt me. He resumed his hunt. I suppose I should have expected it. Where in Hood's name did that knife go, damn it?
Ralik leaned back against a wall. The one you aimed at my throat?
Yes, I'm so...
Yes, you're sorry. Well, you won't find it down there. Try my left shoulder.
Oh, the thickness of blood! Darudistan and her 100,000 hearts, and each and every one beats for none other than this hale, most generous resident of the Phoenix Inn. Seated here at this most grand of tables, although surely Mies should attend to this wobbly leg. Nay, not mine, though that would be delicious indeed, and well beyond common service in said establishment, with... Where was Crupper? Oh, yes, with nary fell company to jiggle awake the night. Tell prescient Crupper, yon friends, why the glowing faces belied by fretful eyes. Did Crupper not promise boons galore? Pressures eased, panics prevented, purses packed with precious baubles all aglitter? Drink up. Oh, humble apologies, we shall order more anon. 'Tis a promise most pertinent should one elect to toast this, that, and perchance t'other.
We got news, Scorch said, looking surprised by his own words. And if you'd just shut your trap, you'd hear about it too.
News? Why, Crupper is news personified. Details, analysis, reactions from common folk in the streets, all in the blink of an eye and the puff of a single breath. Who needs more? This new madness we must witness now weekly, and all the bolts of burlap wasted on which some purple fool blathers all manner of foul gossip. Why, 'tis nothing but rags for the ragman, or wipes for the arse-wipes, or indeed blots for the blotters, bless their feminine wiles. Crupper rails at this elevation of circumstance and incidents. A profession, the fops now claim, as if baying hounds need certification to justify their slavering barks and snarls. Whatever happened to common decency? To decent commonry? What's decent is rarely common. That is true enough, while the obverse is perverse in all prickly irony. Would you not agree? Crupper would, being such an agreeable sort.
We've found Torvald Nom.
Crupper blinked at Leff, then at Scorch, then, seeing perhaps the disbelief mirrored in the face of the latter, back to Leff.
Extraordinary! And did you horribly hand him over to Hirsute Gareb, the lender?
Scorch growled under his breath.
We worked out a better deal, said Leff, licking his lips. Torvald will pay Gareb back in full. And, you see, to do so he had to pay us for the privilege, right? So, Torvald pays us, Gareb pays us. We get paid twice.
Crupper lifted one pudgy finger, on which, he saw with momentary dismay, there was a smear of something unrecognizable.
A moment, please. Torvald has both returned and bought you off? Then why is it Crupper buying the drinks this night? Allow Crupper to answer his own question. Why, because Torvald is yet to pay off trusting Leff and Scorch, yes? He begged, yes, for one night, and all would be well and such.
How do you guess?
Crupper smiled.
Dear foolish friends, should Gareb hear of this any time soon, should he, yes, learn that you had the notorious Torvald Nom in your very grasp, why, you will find your names on the very list you hold, thus forcing you to turn in yourselves to great reward, which will avail you nothing when Gareb hides and quarters poor Scorch and Leff. Ah, calamities await.
Torvald Nom was once our partner, said Leff,
though now sweating in earnest.
He gave us his word, he did. And if he goes back on it, well, doing wrong to Scorch and Leff is never a good idea for anybody. So you keep that in mind too, Crupper, if you go blabbing to Gareb or some such thing.
Beru forbid! Crupper would do no such thing, dearest temperamental friends. Nay, Crupper's fear relates back to those new rags abounding in the grubby hands of urchins at every street corner these days. Such a plague upon Darujistan.
Said rags are nefariously quick and diabolical with their gossip, and who can know the multitude of dubious sources? Crupper worries what the morrow's rag will proclaim.
Damned well better proclaim nothing, snarled Scorch, looking terrified and belligerent all at once.
Now, blessed friends, Crupper said with a perfunctory but flourished wave of his hands, we must end this debacle for tonight. Dread circumstance hovers. Crupper senses stupendous events imminently. Imminent. A taste upon the air, a flutter in the wind, a flicker in the lantern light, a waver in watery pools of ale, a thump upon the stairs, a rattling exposure of front doors. Ho! Noms and flowers, knives and bleeders, faces most ashen and dismayed. Begone from Crupper's table, recent wumplings of desultory concourse. Reunion most precious awaits.
Ralick was leaning heavily against Cutter by the time they reached the entrance to the Phoenix Inn.
Gods, if I've killed him, my friend, gods, no.
Pushing open the door, he half-dragged Ralick inside, and saw behind the counter Meese, beyond her Irilta, and there to his left, frozen in mid-step and staring with wide eyes,
Salty! Ralick's hurt! We need a room and help!
All at once, Meese was pulling the assassin from Cutter's arms.
Hood's breath! He's cut to pieces!
I'm sorry,
Cutter began. But Irilta was now there, taking his face between hands that smelled of ale and chopped garlic, lips suddenly looming large as she planted a full kiss on his mouth, tongue briefly writhing in like a worm down a hole. Cutter reeled back, then found Salty in his arms, grasping him tight, tight with arms astonishingly strong after a dozen or so years of trays and pitchers, so tight all the air was pushed from his lungs.
He'll live,
pronounced Meese from where she crouched over Ralick, who was lying on the floor behind the counter.
Once we stop the bleeding, he must have been jumped by three or four by the looks.
Straightening, she dropped the bloody dagger on the counter. A crowd was gathering, and heads now tilted in for a closer look at that foreign-made weapon.
Melisan!
Hissed someone. Pulling himself from Salty's arms, Cutter pushed through.
Give me room! Don't touch that knife! It's mine!
Yours?
Demanded Irilta.
What's that supposed to mean, Crocus?
He came up on me from behind, all quiet, like a killer. I thought I was defending myself. It was all a mistake. You sure he's going to be all right, Meese?
You was that scrawny thief years back,
said a man with a vaguely familiar face, his expression flitting between disbelief and accusation.
Crocus, Irilta said,
added the man beside him.
Did something the night the moon came down, I heard. Knocked over a pillar or something. You remember Scorch, don't you?
I made a point of remembering only what I need to, Lef. Though sometimes other stuff sticks too. Anyway, he was a pickpocket, one of Crupper's lads.
Well, he ain't any more, is he?
Lef said in a half snarl.
Now he's a guild assassin.
No, I'm not,
shouted Cutter, all at once feeling like the ungainly youth he had been years ago. Furious at his own burning face, he swung to Meese.
Where's everybody else? I mean...
Meese held up a hand, on which there was some of Ralick's blood, and said,
He's waiting, Crocus, at his usual table. Go on.
Hey, she shouted to the crowd, give him a way through. Go back to your tables.
Just like that, Cutter reflected, he had made things a shambles. His grand return. Everything. Reaching out as he passed, he retrieved his knife, not meeting Meese's eyes as he did so. Then, as bodies pulled back, he saw, there, at his usual table, the small round man with greasy hair and beaming cherubic smile, filthy frilly cuffs, a faded and stained red waistcoat, a glistening pitcher on the puddled tabletop, two tankards.
Just a thief, a pickpocket, a raider of girls' bedrooms. Wasn't I the breathless one? Oh, wide-eyed fool! Oh, Crupper, look at you. If anybody wasn't going to change, it's you.
Cutter found himself at the table, collapsing into the waiting chair, reaching for the tankard.
I gave up on my old name, Crupper. It's now Cutter. Better suited, don't you think?
Then why do I feel like weeping? Especially after what I did to Ralik just now.
Crupper's brows lifted.
Crupper sympathizes. Oh, yes, he does. Life stumbles on, although the exception is none other than Crupper himself, for whom life dances. Extraordinary how such truth rubs so many so wrongly. Why, can one's very existence prove sufficient for such inimical outrage? Seems it can. Oh, yes, most certainly. There are always those, dear friend, for whom a wink is an insult, a smile a taunt, for whom humour alone is cause for suspicion, as if laughter was sly contempt. Tell Crupper, dear Cutter, do you believe that we are all equal?
Equal? Well, a laudable notion, we can both agree, yes.
Yet, and he raised one rather unclean finger, is it not true that from one year to the next we each ourselves are capable of changes so fundamental that our present selves can in no reasonable way be considered equal to our past selves? If the rule does not apply even within our own individual lives, how can one dare hope to believe that it pertains collectively?
Crupper, what has all this?
Years past, Cutter, who was once named Crocus, we would not have a discussion such as this, yes? Crupper sees and sees very well. He sees sorrow and wisdom both, pain and still open wounds, love found and love lost, a certain desperation that still spins like a coin. Which way will it fall? Question as yet unanswered, a future as yet undecided. So, old friend now returned, let us drink, thus yielding the next few moments to companionable silence.
And with that, Crupper collected his tankard and lifted it high. Sighing, Cutter did the same.
The spinning coin! And he blanched.
God's below, Crupper.
Drink, friend, drink deep the unknown and unknowable future.
And so he did.
The wheel had stopped spinning, milky water dripping down its sides to gather in the gutters surrounding it. The bright lanterns had been turned well down, sinking the room into soft light, and she now walked towards her bed, drying her hands with a towel. In a day or two, she would fire up the kiln. It was late, and this was no time to be thinking the heavy, turgid thoughts that now threatened to reach up and take hold of her weary mind. Regret has a flavour, and it is stale, and all the cups of tea in the world could do nothing to wash it away. The scratching at the door brought her round. Some drunk at the wrong house, no doubt. She was in no mood to answer. Now Knuckles, tapping with muted urgency. Tisera tossed the towel down, rubbed absently at her aching wrist, then collected one of the heavier stirring sticks from the glaze table and approached the door.
"Wrong house!" she said loudly. "Go on now!"
A fist thumped. Raising the stick, Tisera unlatched the door and swung it back. The man stepping onto the threshold was wearing a stupid grin. One she knew well, had known for years, although it had been some time since she had last seen it. Lowering the stick, she sighed.
"Torvald Nom, you're late." "Sorry, love," he replied. "I got waylaid. Slavers, ocean voyages. Toblakai, Denrabi, torture and crucifixion, a sinking ship. I had no idea going out for a loaf of bread could be so dangerous." "Well," he said, "the whole mess started with me hearing about a debt when I didn't know I had. That bastard Garib set me up, said I owed him when I didn't. But that's not something one can argue, not without an advocate, which we couldn't afford." "I know all about Garib," Tisera replied. "His thugs visited here often enough once you disappeared. And yes, I did need an advocate to get Garib to back off." "He was threatening you?" "He claimed that your debt was my debt, dear husband. Of course, that's nonsense. Even after I won that challenge, he had me followed around. For months... suspected you were in hiding somewhere, and I was delivering food and the like, I suppose. I can't tell you how much fun that was." "Why can't I, Torvald?" "Because it wasn't fun, that is. Not fun at all.
I'm home now, Torvald said, trying the smile again. Wealthy, too. No more debt. I'm clearing that in the morning, straight away. And no more low-grade temper for your clay, either. And a complete replenishment of your herbs, tinctures and such. Speaking of which, just to be safe, we should probably put together a ritual or two.
Oh, really? You've been stealing again, haven't you? Tripped a few wards, did you? Got a bag of coins all glowing with magic, have you? And gems and diamonds. It was only proper love, honest. A wrongful debt dealt with wrongfully. The two happily cancelling each other out, leaving everything rightful.
She snorted, then stepped back and let him inside.
I don't believe I'm buying all this.
You know I never lie to you, Tis, never.
So who did you rob tonight?
Why, Garib, of course. Cleaned him out, in fact.
Tisera stared at him.
Oh, husband. I know, I'm a genius. Now about those wards. As soon as he can, he'll bring in some mages to sniff out the whereabouts of his loot. Yes, Torvald, I grasp the situation well enough. You know where the secret hole is. Drop the bag in there, if you please, while I get started on the rest.
But he had not moved.
Still love me? He asked.
Tisera turned and met his eyes.
Always, you damned fool. Now hurry.
Glories unending this night in Darujistan. And now the dawn stirs awake, a light to sweep aside the blue glow of the unsleeping city. See the revelers stumbling towards their beds, or the beds of newfound friends, or even a stranger's bed. What matter the provenance of love? What matter the tangled threads of friendship so stretched and knotted? What matter the burdens of life, when the sun blazes into the sky and the gulls stir from their posts in the bay, when crabs scuttle for deep and dark waters? Not every path is well trod, dearest friends. Not every path is set out with even paved stones and unambiguous signs. Rest eyes in the manner of a thief who is a thief no longer, as he looks with deepest compassion down upon the sleeping face of an old friend there in a small room on the upper floor of the Phoenix Inn, and sees too a noble councilman snoring slouched in yon chair, while in the very next room sits an assassin who is, perhaps, an assassin no longer, dull-eyed with pain as he ponders all manner of things in fashions sure to be mysterious and startling, were any able to peek into his dark mind. Elsewhere, a child long ago abandoned by his mother frets in his sleep, pursued by a nightmare face with the absurd name of Snell attached to it. And two guards run, hearts pounding, from the gate to the estate as alarms ring loud and urgent, for an evil man has lost all his ill-won wealth, a fact as sure to pluck his talons as a torturer's pliers, since evil only thrives in a well of power. And when the coin of cruelty is stolen away, why, so too vanishes the power. A fingerless man stumbles home, God-blessed and blood oozing from battered knuckles, while his wife sleeps without dreams, her expression so peaceful even the most unsentimental sculptor could do naught but weep. And in a street unworthy of any particular notice stands an ox, thinking about breakfast. What else is there, after all, when love and friendship and power and regret and loss and reunion, fierce enough to tear away all that might have been bittersweet, when all is gone and done with, what else is there but the needs of the stomach? Eat, dine on pleasures and taste sweet life. Inconsequential? Bah! As Crupper ever says, it is a wise ox that gets the yoke.